In Dr. Jeremy Engels' forthcoming book on mindful democracy, he writes, "Democracy is an ongoing practice of taking care of each other and of this miraculous, messy, wonderful, perplexing, oft-challenging life we share. Slow down and look deeply, and you'll discover an inescapable fact of being human. Everyone hurts sometimes." In today's episode, we have an interview with Dr. Jeremy Engels.
Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Phil, where can folks find us?
You can subscribe to the Thriveology Lab podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a message or question, and we'll be sure to respond. You can message us at thriveologylab@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we have an interview with Dr. Jeremy Engels, author of the forthcoming book On Mindful Democracy, which is where our opening quote is from. Jeremy Engels is a communication ethicist who studies democracy's past so that we can imagine new and better democratic futures. He is the author of The Ethics of Oneness, Emerson, Whitman, and the Bhagavad Gita, The Art of Gratitude, The Politics of Resentment, A Genealogy, and Enemyship, Democracy and Counter-Revolution in the Early Republic. For his work, he has been awarded the Carl Wallace Award and the New Investigator Award from the National Communication Association. Professor Engels teaches courses in communication and mindfulness, the rhetoric of war and peace, communication ethics, and democratic theory. In recognition of his outstanding efforts in the classroom, he was awarded the Penn State College of the Liberal Arts Outstanding Tenure Line Faculty Teaching Award in spring 2017. Jeremy is also a trained yoga and meditation teacher, and he was one of my yoga teachers during my own certification and my friend. Welcome, Jeremy.
Well, thanks for having me. This is such a pleasure.
Oh, it's great to have you here.
So maybe we just start right off the bat. Like, what do you mean when you talk about mindful democracy, big picture, and then we can start zoom into maybe some finer points?
Sure. So one of the things that I have become convinced of in teaching about and researching democracy, and you know, I've written several books about democracy. I teach classes on civic education and, you know, preparing students for democracy. And I think that we've gotten democracy all wrong today in many ways. And it's been a slow process over many, many years, but, you know, this thing that we call democracy has become, you know, this war between two political parties that are backed up by special interests and wealthy elites. And when you look at the striking, just looking at like the New York Times or something like that, just about the shutdown right now. For those listening in the future, there is still a government of the United States at this point. It is currently shut down. The reporting is about, you know, which party is going to benefit from this and what's good for Democrats and what's good for Republicans. And lost in all of that is what is good for the people, what is good for us. And that ultimately is what democracy really is about. You know, the power of the people. And so I've been thinking a lot about civic renewal, democratic renewal. What does that mean? What does that actually look like in practice? And I think that one thing that really helps is to bring mindfulness into our practices of democracy. And so, of course, the question is, what do you mean by mindfulness, right? Because that word it's so popular today, it's everywhere. And when I talk about mindfulness in the book, I mean the practice of learning how to notice and pay attention to whatever is happening right now. So that idea of paying attention to what's happening in the present moment is really important for mindfulness. But it goes beyond that, because in a lot of the mindfulness literature, really the point of mindfulness is about stress relief, about feeling a little more calm. And that is great. Like we really need that. We need that. But in a lot of the mindfulness texts, the texts coming out of Buddhism, you know, mindfulness is a practice of stopping, shamatha, of slowing down, and then of looking deeply, and looking deeply and gaining insight, insight into ourselves, insight into the world, insight into our relationships with others. And when you really slow down and look deeply, what you notice is how deeply interconnected and interdependent we are. There is no me without you. There is no me or you without us. There is no us without trees or rain or oceans. Truly, we're interconnected. And so to me, a rich, deep practice of mindfulness leads naturally towards an ethics of care, not just for ourselves, but for others. And that really then becomes the foundation of a reimagined democracy.
I love that idea, and I've so enjoyed reading the early release of your book that we were privileged to yeah. read, and it is so kind of antithetical to what we see in modern politics, which is, as you mentioned, this very much about winning, but even also about inflicting pain and almost the joy of, you know, owning the libs, for example, right? And and yeah, that this kind of politics of division and pain and really kind of this, you know, these are kind of standard tactics from authoritarian playbooks that have been used not just in the U.S. but kind of globally that we're seeing play out in the U.S. And it's a politics of us versus them. It's a politics of division, which is and you're really bringing this. One of the things I got out of reading the book was very much this ethic of care and this focus on interdependence and what it, you know, to think of politics as we rather than just what's in this for me? What do I get out of this selfishly? I want to ask to some extent, like how you came to this. You know, I see, like, my own research is about authoritarianism and the VDEM Institute, which kind of studies the health of democracies globally, has said, like, for the first time in 20 years, we have more people living under autocracy than democracy in the world. And they have documented a real slide in the U.S. toward illiberalism, away from liberal democracy. And I guess my question is, how does this context feed into your wanting to write this book now?
Yeah. 2026 will be the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence in the United States. And so that's a really important civic moment for us, an anniversary. And I've thought long and hard about some of the challenges of truly trying to live in the world as like a rugged individual. You know, we have all of these mantras in the United States, right? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, paddle your own canoe. So many of them come from Ben Franklin, actually, which is really interesting.
And the images of the cowboy or the homesteader, mm-hmm. all of these, you know, this is very much American mythology.
Yeah. And it's mythology is exactly the right word. And I love myth, and myth can be very compelling. But when you look at the stories of homesteaders, they were receiving often tremendous help from their neighbors. It wasn't as though anyone was building a life alone. And I think that reassessing and making space for the kinds of collaboration and cooperation that are already always happening all the time, and acknowledging those can be just a different way of looking at the world and being in the world than the kind of politics of resentment, lashing out at the enemy, seeking revenge, that seems to be really popular today. And so, you know, when I think of, you know, I wrote a book called The Politics of Resentment that was about the rise of this kind of, rather than trying to genuinely deal with the structural problems that were causing people pain, at many moments in American history, politicians have found it really useful instead to harness the resentment that people feel, legitimate resentment often, right? Because resentment is closely related to a feeling of injustice. Something has gone wrong. This is not right. But we don't know quite how to fix it. And politicians today say that we're going to fix it by punishing someone else, by lashing out at someone else, by inflicting cruelty and pain on others.
By blaming immigrants, right? Which is a very common trope for scapegoating societal problems. I mean, this, exactly. In this area in 2016, when the Sanders and Trump were both running for their own respective, you know, primaries, I heard people around here saying I would vote for Trump or Sanders. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if you think of this just in left right, that doesn't make sense. But where their message overlapped was the system is rigged. It's not working for the average person. You know, people can't afford housing. They can't afford health care. It's hard. The American dream is slipping away. And so, yeah, to your point, I'm just kind of echoing this idea that the resentment, I think, on across the spectrum is this genuine sense that the system is broken.
What? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that you know that point about myth is so important, I think, and as someone who teaches and works in theater, story is my bread and butter. But I think one of the things, you know, we talk and you probably talk with your students is like when we as individuals and certainly sort of as a nation get caught up in the story and don't recognize when it's become a fiction, like the stories I tell myself about myself that may not actually be true. And one of the benefits I see in my own life and from the book is like what mindfulness, a mindful approach to this is allowing us is to sort of see in that, like what is true, what is false, how have I sort of been misled into this fiction, just as I might with myself as well.
Yeah, I mean, mindfulness in a lot of ways is a practice of getting to know ourselves better and getting to know our conditioning better and getting to know ourselves as participants in ideologies and propaganda and stories, myths, you know, that influence us. And so I think one of the stories right now about democracy is that democracy is about winning and also about punishing, about victory. And so this ethic of scapegoating. And if mindfulness is about learning to pay attention to what is happening right now, to really be present with something, can we really be present with our pain in a way that allows us to really try to understand actually its sources, its causes, and then to look at the solutions that are being offered to us and really honestly judge whether they're being effective at making that suffering better. And they're not, because they're not addressing the structural causes that are actually causing the suffering in the first place. And so I think that's one thing that mindfulness potentially can help with. It's not easy. I mean, it's not easy to be with one's suffering, right? At all. Yeah.
It's easy to blame somebody else. It's easy to
much easier
demonize or enemy ship somebody else. Yeah. And that's interesting, your point of that. And you've spent a lot of time at Plum Village, which was the retreat center of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk and peace activist. And you quote their work at one point saying, make good use of your suffering. And can you say more about that? What does that mean? It seems maybe to someone counterintuitive.
Yeah, there are lots of wonderful sayings associated with the Plum Village tradition that on their surface don't really seem to make any sense. And I love that. You know, I love one of the things I really treasure about Zen Buddhism is the way that it challenges language. And as a rhetorical scholar, someone who studies communication, you know, I'm always deeply interested in language and the paradoxes of language. And so make good use of your suffering would be recognizing that suffering is something that all of us have. It is innate to being human. And that does not mean that human life is all suffering. It does not mean that human life is not worth living. It is. And there is joy, too. But can we be with our suffering in a way that points us towards something better? That points us actually towards a path out of that suffering rather than compounding it. And I think that's really what it means to make good use of our suffering. And so much of that involves connecting to others. Can our suffering turn us towards connection with others rather than causing us to fold back in on ourselves and taking refuge in TikTok or social media or something like that? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I, you know, I was thinking as you're saying that it's sometimes it feels like we don't only have a myth problem, but a metaphor problem, that how we frame democracy is war. Then all the things that cascade out of that, I think a lot about the work of George Lakoff's sort of metaphors we live by and sort of how get embedded in our just almost unconscious language choices, because we have these frameworks, democracy is war. And so I think what I also hear you saying is like mindfulness also, as I notice how have I framed the world? How have I been conditioned to frame the world? And how is that coming into my right or wrong speech in the world? Maybe in ways I've not been mindful about just because they've become habitual.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
The difference between framing crime as crime versus war has big implications for how we view it as a society, because we acknowledge why crime is bad. We want to minimize it. Crime can never surrender.
Right.
It's a concept that
will always exist. Or the war on drugs. Yeah.
And where war implies all of society's resources until the other side gives up. But the concept of crime is never going to give up. That's something we do our best to manage. Right, acknowledging that it's just part of the human condition. You have this, you related this kind of no mud, no lotus, and you know, and I think of, you know, it, which is related, I think, to this, you know, make good use of your suffering, and I think to the civil rights movement, you know, Martin Luther King, and the civil rights legislation that came out of that, and the breakdown of Jim Crow laws, and you know, as examples of exactly what we're talking about here, you know, how do you take suffering and transform it into something better? And I think we're you know, we're in one of those moments where we have a lot of suffering, and we have leadership whose answer seems to be to cause more suffering, and you know, and then the question is how do we get out of that? How do we go from the mud to the lotus?
Yeah, and I love that phrase, no mud, no lotus, because lotus flowers grow from the mud. And so it's a, you know, it's a call to think about what we grow out of the mud of suffering, the muck. And there's so much of it right now. And it's interesting, actually. I've been talking with some of my friends who are also mindfulness teachers, who also, you know, study and practice in the Plum Village tradition. And, you know, I've asked them, you know, how are you doing? Are you feeling crestfallen? Are you feeling, you know, with everything that's going on? And almost uniformly, everyone I've talked to has felt energized, actually, by this moment. If now is not the moment that we need to be practicing and helping others to practice and showing them a better way, then there is no moment to do that. And so there's a way in which challenge can actually call out the best of us. And I think that's going to be one thing that we're going to have to rise to over the coming months, because there's going to be many invitations to be the worst. I mean, we see them constantly. And which way it's going to go, I don't really know, actually. I mean, I think that people's reservoirs of strength and compassion are pretty deep, actually, when it comes to interacting locally with people, you know, on the scene. So we'll see. I don't know.
Can you expand on that? Because I think that's such a important point. I mean, I was in a conversation yesterday with students and faculty, and we were talking about, you know, kind of current political climate. And one of the students said, you know, that they often look to faculty to feel reassured. And what's making them nervous is they look to faculty and they see us shaken and, you know, and not, maybe not energized in the way you're describing. So for those of us who are feeling scared and have this tendency to maybe withdraw and feel helpless, like in concrete ways, how are you doing that? I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm going around trying to think about how I can set a good example for my students, like in a concrete way. Like I'd like to embody a good example for them, but I feel like that puts too much pressure on everything. Making good use of our suffering, no mud, no lotus. Another phrase the Plum Village tradition really likes is the way out is in, which is the only way out of a crisis of democracy is through that crisis of democracy. We can't avoid it. We can't go around it. It's not like some figure is going to come from another world and save all of us, even if that would be wonderful if it would happen. Like, we're going in. And so I try to remember that we're going in. This is what is happening right now. And I don't deny the feelings of fear and anxiety that are present, because they are, and they're real, and I think that they're justified. There are really frightening and scary things going on right now. But I also remember the connections I have to others. I remember my communities. I remember the support that exists. And I come back to my practice pretty frequently of, you know, if I find myself spiraling off, which is, you know, minds like to do that, right? Come back to the breath, come back to my feet, come back to looking at the trees, come back to feeling the air on my skin, and finding that place of center, that place of standing on common ground, and then trying to re-engage from that place. Because I think that, you know, so much of what happens, at least what I'm seeing right now, I mean, and in a lot of ways, these are unprecedented times for us, not unprecedented times for the world. Right. There are lots of historical examples we can look at, is that so much of what's happening right now knocks us off balance. And when we're off balance, it's really difficult to engage in a healthy way. And so coming back to a more balanced place, really feeling that, you know, standing on common ground, which is a central metaphor in my book. That's what I'm trying to do right now. But I'm curious what you all are doing, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, one of my own challenges is trying to be. I often feel the pressure of presenting a good face, of like being the stoic, being emotionally like I right. And I think what I'm trying to challenge myself with is being more authentic and present in the room with students in particular, however that sort of translates. And that in and of itself is a scary place to be, because it's maybe unfamiliar ground for me. But I think it's also helping me just be a bit kinder in the classroom in how I treat students. When I used to, I come from a sort of theater tradition that's a little bit rigorous and militaristic in nature, and I can tend to, that can sort of seep into the way I sort of run rehearsals and such. So that's one. I don't know if that's well, and it's also the feeling like, is that enough? It's not enough, and it feels like sometimes it's not the thing. Phil, what about you? What are you?
I mean, I'm going to just push back a little bit, saying I don't know if it's not enough, and that we all do what we can when we can, and that's going to flex. And I'll say, like you, Jeremy, I'm doing a lot of breathing, and I'm keeping my morning mindfulness practice going, and some of my yoga, and I teach Tai Chi, and these are things that help me connect with myself, and it's kind of check in with where I'm at on a daily basis and help me connect with others. And then I guess the part I think, you know, I'm struggling with, many of us are struggling with, is what do I do, right, from that place? If, as well as I'm able to maintain my center, which is always, of course, a moving target, how do I engage those around me in my community who are being told that I'm their enemy because I'm in a different political ideology, right? And I guess so. That's the concrete ways in which I'm like, does that mean op-eds that try and talk about our connection and, you know, the things you bring up in your book? Like, I guess, yeah, that's kind of what I'm struggling with, is these very concrete ways in which, how do we build bridges in this, you know, hyper polarized environment that is full of hate? And you talk a lot about in the book about hate does not defeat hate, right? Only love can do that. And I think that's such a powerful message and such a central one. And I have to remind myself to bring that, because it is easy to become resentful and, you know, you get hurt and so you want to hurt back, but that just leads to more suffering.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And, you know, in one of the later chapters of the book, maybe the next to the last chapter, I try to detail some specific things that people can do to practice on mindful democracy. And, you know, a lot of it's about building community. It's about creating networks of support, and communities in particular that embody a different vision of democracy. And, you know, I am really inspired by Thich Nhat Hanh and Martin Luther King and, you know, the Reverend James Lawson and others during the civil rights movement who believed that they had to embody love. And that ultimately would be the thing that would win out. You know, I think we need everybody doing everything they possibly can that they're called to do. But I think we need to do it from an ethics of care and an ethics of love, as opposed to an ethics of, you know, resentment or scapegoating.
Well, and there's several ways, you know, and a lot of those structures that you've mentioned in the book, I think, are really powerful. The one I'm going to try to get to here through a prelude here is the Five Agreements of Mindful Deliberation. And one of the books that Phil and I really like is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And and he talks in the book sort of about, you know, the creating a gap between a stimulus and then the response. And the more time you have, you can make then a thoughtful and mindful response rather than a reaction. And, you know, you talk a lot about sort of the world, particularly around sort of technology in our work life, asks us to go, 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 rush, 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 rush. And when we're in that tempo, it's nearly impossible to make thoughtful, mindful responses to things. You're taking the first reaction and you've got to go. And it's usually an emotional one rather than a rational or ethical one. And so I really loved these five agreements, because I was like, even as I think about how we talk about anything in class or in life or in politics, having this sort of structure of how to talk sounds like it's very by the book, but it gives the speaker and the listener ways to approach that. And so here's the quote, and I'll get to those five, and I'd love to hear you speak on that. So the quote is, "Deliberation is the practice of engaging in thoughtful discussion to make informed decisions, and as such is one of humanity's greatest inventions. Deliberation is a way to practice mindfulness together." And you have these five agreements, which, number one, we are all in this together, which you've said. 2, speak up and listen up. 3, stay on topic. Practice the 5 questions. And those 5 questions are, what are the pros of this position? What are the cons? What are the unknowns? What are the quality of evidence do I have? And finally, what do we do if we get it wrong? And then the final is, it's okay to change your mind. I love that as such a just a great structure for that. Could you speak about that, maybe how that came to be, or
yeah, any thoughts of course on that? So one of the things that I think is really special about my my department, so I'm in a department of communication arts and sciences, and those, you know, around the country, it's mostly a Midwestern field. It's a field actually that grows out of the land grant mission of a lot of big universities of trying to train people for democratic citizenship. And so communication departments traditionally have taught public speaking, which is usually not anybody's favorite class. You know, some people like it okay. You know, I taught it for a long time as a grad student, and I taught in a community college when I was a grad student for a while too. And then sometimes public speaking classes are adapted to become more like deliberation classes or disagreement classes. We have an amazing class at Penn State where I teach called Rhetoric and Civic Life. And it's a class that teaches students how to speak, how to write, and how to deliberate and engage with others. And you know, being involved with that class for a long time, you know, we talked quite a bit about what are some guidelines or some rules for deliberation. And that course created a set of guidelines. And then over the past 10 years or so, I began adapting them in my classes and changing them around and adding them and deleting. And they became something very different. But these agreements, and I think of them as agreements rather than rules, because nobody likes rules. I have to follow these, but agreements instead are something that we accede to, you know, something that we agree to do because it will be, you know, good for us or it will help. And these agreements really came out of working with my students in classes where, all right, we're going to have a deliberation this week and we're going to talk about this really controversial issue. And finding that after 10 or 15 minutes, we needed to pause, we needed to hit a mindfulness bell, and we needed to sit for 3 minutes and restart. Or we needed some questions to help to guide us, or we needed reassurance that it's okay to change your mind, because at some point it became wrong to change your mind. I don't know how that happened, right? Flip-flopping and all of that. And so that's really the way that the agreements came about.
And I love that idea of agreement instead of rules. Again, sort of a metaphor situation, like the way you're talking about this and framing this, agreement speaks to the common ground. We are coming together on this. Rules is top down. Authority says this. And yeah, even such a simple switch in language in that regard is powerful.
Yeah. And I think that these agreements are easily adaptable in other spaces too. It's not just a classroom space. It could be any group of friends that gets together to talk about anything that's important to them, any community that deliberates on something that's important to them, at least is the hope. But going back to that theme of deliberation, you know, I think that mindfulness practice, one of the beauties of the practice is that it creates space. And so in our neoliberal attention economy, we're asked to respond instantly over and over again to stimuli, to questions. And building in that pause between stimulus and response, between action and then not reaction, but response.
That's a very different thing.
Yeah, it makes everything more deliberate. And that's how I view deliberation as well, democratic deliberation. It's like how we collectively take a pause and consider before acting.
I love that idea. And because so much of what argument and deliberation I think, in an idealized sense, are about coming closer to the truth. Mm. And what that's been replaced with is winning and ego. And this, we all fall into this naturally. You know, my partner and I are having a disagreement, right? I want to be right, right? And so I think that's a very natural trap. And it's much harder to say, like, actually, you know, to kind of let go of that ego. And so this isn't actually what this is about. You know, this is about building community or building connection or getting to some common understanding of the truth. And I want to loop back to kind of what you're saying about civics education, because it really seems like when I think about how we got here in this moment in the U.S. and how we get out of it, this seems like a huge part of it. I mean, polling shows that most Americans can't name the three branches of government, for example, as a very factual, basic thing. Before we even get into things like dispositional characteristics that you need to bring into a democracy, and you write, democracy demands the skills we learn by practicing meditation, paying attention, slowing down, pausing judgment, looking deeply, speaking lovingly, and listening carefully. In fact, I've come to think of mindfulness as a type of civic education. For democracy to regain its power to change lives in the world, we the people must learn to live more mindfully. I love kind of what that sentiment and how that expresses it. And I'm wondering how you see this kind of importance of civic education, and not just in formal senses like in the classroom, but more broadly, right? How do we, you know, how do we get that lotus from the mud that we're in, right? How do we bring this out in ways that engage as many people as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be one of our challenges, you know, us over the next few years, is having a renaissance of civic education, of re-emphasizing our responsibilities towards each other as citizens, which is something that I think has really slipped a lot. And part of that is just, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see the way, you know, I don't have children, and so I'm not exactly sure like how kids are actually learning civics. I mean, I remember I had like a civics class when I was in seventh grade or something like that. And you know, when you're 13 years old and all you care about is baseball and whatnot. I mean, like, that was even before social media. You know, and then I learned a lot more about it and came to care, you know, as a high school student and then as an undergraduate when it seemed like it was a little bit more relevant to me. So I think we're going to need to reassess the way that we're teaching people civics. And I don't know if there's a way to make it as interesting as it truly is, because I think that that's one of the ways that social media operates, by giving us interesting content to look at. But often the things that are happening in the world are more interesting. And so that's where we direct our attention. If democracy really truly becomes about how we care for each other, how we manage our suffering, how we put ourselves on a path towards joy together, that to me is much more interesting than democracy as a war.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And so I think maybe reframing things, new metaphors, new images might help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also think, you know, you mentioned social media, and there's a good bit of research showing that kind of the flood of misinformation does cause this kind of democratic backslide in countries around the world, right? That seems to be a causal factor. And authoritarian fascist movements deliberately use this, you know, flooding the zone and with misinformation. But then I also wonder how much, in thinking about the civics education and what spaces this happens in, how much of that needs to happen then also on social media as a way of reaching people where they're at. Because while I agree that it's ideal to step away from that some, that's also where people are.
But I'm also inspired by, like, I feel like the, particularly sort of like the first years, I don't know if this is true for Penn State as well, the students that are coming to us now seem to be much more aware of this and some of the harmful effects of it, and they're distancing themselves. So I was like, I don't necessarily want to engage in that or participate that in the way that perhaps even a couple of years ago they were more engaged. I think that's the trend I'm seeing. I hope it is. I hear people saying it, and certainly in the course that Phil and I teach, you know, we have students who are actively like, I really want a better life here. What are some ways I can do this?
Which is, yeah, I've been seeing inspiring. That too. Yep. It is. It's very encouraging.
They do seem to be more aware of the negative health aspects, but at the same time, I wonder how effective they are. It's one thing to recognize a problem. It's another thing to be able to disengage and, mm-hmm. and moderate, from it. So, But I agree, it is a hopeful sign that there is the recognition, because without that you can't go anywhere. You use this term, Jeremy, you know, not just friendship but enemyship, and I wonder if you could unpack that term for us and what that means.
Sure. So that, as far as I know, that phrase was, or that word was coined by Thomas Paine in Common Sense. Back during the Revolutionary era, and that's where I encountered it first. And working on my dissertation was about the rhetorics that were used to found the United States and to tame the democratic energies that were necessary for winning the revolution, but then became immediately threatening to the new government. And the argument I made in my first book was that enemieship was the way that this was done, and that it's become a central rhetorical tactic of governance. And enemieship is simply creating a sense, a felt embodied sense of us versus them. And so a friendship usually is based on shared interests or kind feelings or something like that. Enemieship instead is based simply upon a shared enemy. So it's inherently fragile, because the moment that enemy is no longer an enemy, is defeated or goes away, then those bonds themselves no longer have a grounding. And enemieship operates by naming an enemy. So taking a figure and then stripping them of everything that makes them human. And then creating a gap or a distance that makes it impossible to communicate, because as soon as you talk to someone, you realize that actually they're human too. So enemieship denies communication, and then it escalates. Fear, 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 resentment, anger, 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 rage. That's the way enemieship works. And so it's a rhetorical strategy that really tries to flood us and then tries to provoke immediate violent responses to things. So I think fundamentally the way enemieship works is that it really strips us of our agency, because we just become reactive beings instead of being responsible.
And to your point, 100 years ago, I was, as you probably know, I was in the Army. And one of the things they do in talking about sort of, you do like these field exercises with some sort of fictional enemy and a plan. And one of the things that you do is immediately give that other person, that other group, a code name, something that is like, you know, all other than human. They're no longer human. They are this thing. They are, you know, whatever the code name is for that group or person. So because they know it's really hard to take violent action if I know that person's name, it's, you know, it's harder to kill the cow if you've named him Betsy, right? Right. And so once I've made it a human. So, and we see that in that rhetoric, in in less obvious ways as well.
I think it's a really good point because we are inherently social beings evolutionarily, and we are actually not very predisposed to violence. We, you know, that really has to be provoked, trained, built, and this enemyship, this sense of someone else as inherently threatening to your existence is a big part of how that is made, right? And this is a lot of the rhetoric we're seeing. I mean, my oldest son lives in Chicago, and we go to Chicago quite regularly and visit.
Yeah.
Beautiful place, love going there. And if your only knowledge of that came from kind of some of these, you know, the propaganda that is on some networks, you would think that it is, you know, just completely crime ridden, you know, literally flames and bombs all over the place and this chaos, and that Democrats somehow want it to be that way, and so therefore they're the enemy, and immigrants want it to be that way, and therefore they're the enemy. And so these messages that feed this enemyship frame, you know, they're very deliberately designed to provoke something that is inherent in all of us, which is a desire to be safe. You know, and I think, again, this is the interconnection, this idea that somehow, you know, well, you know, one group says like, oh, well, you know, they want to destroy America and destroy us. Well, like, actually, what we all want is to be able to live peacefully, to have freedom, to marry who we want, right? To have our children go to safe schools, to pursue life, liberty, and happiness as it fits with ourselves. And that's
our common ground.
That's our common ground, right?
Yeah.
When is this? You mentioned this book is forthcoming. Neil and I have had the pleasure of reading it. I can't wait for this to come out. And because I think this is just so timely in addressing the mud that we're in. Because we need paths forward. We need to be building things that help get us through this in a positive way. Do you have a timeline for when is this released?
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be out on February 3rd, 2026. And it's being published by Parallax Press, which is the press that Thich Nhat Hanh started in the 1980s. It's a fantastic press. They work with Penguin Random House now, so they have some nice distribution. But the staff at Parallax is just—they're delightful. It's been such a wonderful experience working with them, and so the book is all. I believe it's in production as of yesterday, I think.
Oh,
and
oh,
so,
congratulations.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. So it's being printed right now, and we'll see it, in the new year, which I'm really excited about. And then there'll be some opportunities to visit campuses and talk, especially with college students. I'm really excited about that. So maybe I'll be able to swing down and see you all.
We would love that.
Absolutely.
I think I'll be tagging my provost very shortly with that suggestion.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, absolutely. You've mentioned Plum Village and Thich Nhat Hanh several times. For people who don't know, can you briefly tell us? I know, you know, there's a long story of Thich Nhat Hanh, but a brief summary, and what is Plum Village, and what is your connection to that?
Yeah, of course. Thich Nhat Hanh was born in the 1920s. He passed away in 2022, and he had a long life. But he was born in central Vietnam and grew up in that region, you know, during wartime. He became a Zen Buddhist monk, though he ran afoul of some of the orthodoxies of the Buddhist church because he believed in a doctrine of engaged Buddhism. And so this idea that actually, it's our job not just to pursue self-enlightenment, but to make the world a better place, and that actually working to reduce the suffering in the world is a path towards enlightenment and connection and freeing ourselves of our own suffering. And during the 1960s, he was deeply involved in resettling people who were lost their houses during the war, the American War, as they call it, in Vietnam, the Vietnam War, as we call it. He and several of his students, just did amazing work during that moment and really helping people out. And he became friends during the 1960s with Martin Luther King Jr. And they exchanged letters, and he visited with Dr. King. Dr. King nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967, but he that year there was no prize. And there's a really interesting story about why we think that was the case. Thich Nhat Hanh refused to take a side during the war. He said, it's not that the Americans are the enemies or the North Vietnamese that are enemies. War itself is the enemy, and hatred and greed are the enemies. And for that position, he was exiled from his homeland for almost 40 years. He wasn't allowed to return home. And during that time, because there was a large Vietnamese population in France, because France had colonized Vietnam for a long time, he settled in Paris initially, and then set up a monastery south of Paris in a really beautiful area of France. And that monastery is called Plum Village. And since then, he and his students have set up monasteries around the world. There's three in the United States. There's one in New York that's not very far from us, actually. It's a beautiful place called Blue Cliff. And those are practice centers and places of refuge for people to go and to practice, to learn how to practice mindfulness, to get away from things. Thich Nhat Hanh, when he passed away, several magazines called him the father of mindfulness. He taught a particular kind of mindfulness, but he introduced a lot of us to that practice. And I love it because it's a worldly mindfulness. It's a mindfulness that's invested in community and connection and trying to make the world better in really concrete ways. So I mostly knew Thich Nhat Hanh, actually, I exclusively knew Thich Nhat Hanh through books and through, online videos. But in 2018, I was really fortunate to be able to take a pilgrimage to India, India and Nepal, with some of the monks from Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition. And one of Thich Nhat Hanh's senior students, his name is Shantam Seth. He's just an amazing teacher in India. And my wife Anna and I went, and we visited the important sites of the Buddha's life. So we got to see where the Buddha was born and where he was enlightened. We got to sit under the Bodhi tree, we got to see where he gave the Four Noble Truths lectures. And we got to spend time at his rain retreat, where he spent a lot of his winters, and we saw where he passed away. And that was really the moment where I connected more deeply with this practice tradition and began practicing my own kind of mindfulness practice in this tradition. And, I've studied a lot of different kinds of meditation, but this one is one that's become really important to me. And so I've been really fortunate to connect with a lot of people in that tradition around the world. And it's nice. It's a big global community of people who are really committed to doing good things and living lovingly. So, yeah. So thanks for asking about that.
Sure. Now, I love the engaged part of Buddhism. You also write, Neil and I have done several episodes on mindfulness, and we ourselves have ongoing practices and conversations about mindfulness. And you write about something that, we've talked about, and I think most serious practitioners do, the ways in which mindfulness has been utilized in society and maybe in a particularly capitalistic sense of, you know, if we offer this mindfulness program at our corporation, you'll be better workers, you know, or maybe just, you know, it reduces your stress, which again is a wonderful thing because we need stress reduction. But that's really just sometimes a misrepresentation, but often just really a shallow, you know, kind of dipping your toe in what is this just huge well of knowledge and inspiration, and this, you know, again, this kind of focus on loving kindness, which is about so much more than just I feel less stressed.
And I think too, and we've mentioned this word a bunch of times, this idea of practice. And, you know, even in the class that we teach on Monday, we ask the students how their practice was going. And they're like, well, sometimes not, I'm not keeping up with it. And I feel better when I do, or, you know, they know this. Like, and I think, and this will tie into our challenge this week. I think I'm going to pivot on our challenge, Phil. But like, I think that like that all of the, to me, and correct me if you think this is wrong, I think that all the benefits that we've been talking about emerge out of a practice, emerge out of consistently making time to sit. Because like one of the metaphors we often use, like going to the gym, like you're not going to get the benefits just once. You got to keep going back and back. And so you're highlighting something, Phil. You would.
Oh, no, I'm listening to you and also just thinking in my head. No, it's there are two quotes here. We're, you know, coming to the end of our hour. And to me, they just sum up so much of what we've talked about. And I think your point about the practice is really important because it's, you don't, you know, as we've talked about, it's not like you find balance and then just stay there. It's balancing, right? This is a constant practice because life throws curveballs at us all the time and we're constantly adjusting to what's around us. The two quotes I just want to read here. The first one, the world's biggest lie is that some people are naturally more important and more deserving of safety, happiness, and well-being than other people. We refute this lie. Such a powerful sentence. Yeah. And then the next one, the point is to transform how we live in the world so that we suffer less and inflict less suffering on others, and then to build engaged communities that are capable of transforming the world itself, making it a less painful and a more caring place for one and all. And I just want to thank you, Jeremy, for your efforts in helping to realize that in some small way. I mean, that the book, I really hope it is a number one, you know, New York Times bestseller book list because it is so needed.
Yeah.
And I'm being quite sincere. I think it really addresses in so many books describe the problem and, you know, and what we need are solutions. And this is just a really powerful and convincing one.
And thank you, Jeremy, my friend, for making time to chat with us today. You're awesome. I'm so grateful to have you in my life in whatever capacity I can. Friends, your challenge this week. If you've fallen off from a practice, see if you can make time again. Even if it's 5 minutes a day, start where you can start and pick up where you need to pick up. I know as academics and our lives get more hectic as the semester goes on or your life, like it's easy for things to like, well, I'll just do it later and then later never comes. So your challenge this week, if you make time for your practice in whatever way, as Jeremy was saying, you can.
It's a great challenge. Sometimes when we get stressed and busy, that's when our practice falls off. It's also, I think, when we need it the most.
The most, yeah.
So, thank you again, Jeremy. Yeah,
thank you.
That's it for this episode. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have questions or comments, or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on.
Thrive on, friends.